glories to Asimba devotees. All glories to Asimba devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guru Maharaj. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Bastaya Bhikkhave Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Kanamani Namaste Sarasthi Devam Gaura Vandi Vachani Nirvashesha Shunya Vadi Vastachari Zitara. Is this the best position for the microphone here? Seems kind of hot. I don't know. I feel like I'm looking through. Yeah. Hare Krishna. Well, that sounds better. Okay. We are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 4, the four categories of annihilation, and we are covering text 15 through 23 today. The first eight verses or so are fairly technical. I think we'll just read through the English on those, and then we'll do 23 responsively. Okay, so this is starting with text 15, and this is a continuation of the description of annihilation, of how all the different elements merge into one another. So starting with 15. Not working? Okay, I'll just read the translations here. The element fire then seizes the taste from the element water, which, deprived of its unique quality taste, merges into fire. Air seizes the form inherent in fire, and then fire, deprived of form, merges into air. The element either seizes the quality of air, the element ether, not either, the element ether seizes the quality of air, namely touch, and that air enters into ether. Then, O King, false ego in ignorance seizes sound, the quality of ether, after which ether merges into false ego. False ego in the mode of passion takes hold of the senses, and the false ego in the mode of goodness absorbs the demigods. Then the total Mahatattva seizes false ego along with its various functions, and that Mahat is seized by the three basic modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. My dear King Pariksit, these modes are further overtaken by the original unmanifest form of nature impelled by time. That unmanifest nature is not subject to the six kinds of transformations caused by the influence of time. Rather, it has no beginning and no end. It is the unmanifested, eternal, infallible cause of creation. Next 20 and 21. In the unmanifest stage of material nature called pradana, there is no expression of words, no mind, no manifestation of the subtle elements beginning from the mahat, nor are there the modes of nature, goodness, passion, ignorance. There is no life, air, or intelligence, nor any senses or demigods. There is no definite arrangement of planetary systems, nor are there present the different stages of consciousness, sleep, wakefulness, and deep sleep. There is no ether, water, earth, air, fire, or sun. The situation is just like that of complete sleep or of voidness. Indeed, it is indescribable. Authorities in spiritual science explain, however, that since pradana is the original substance, it is the actual basis of material creation. Text 22. This is the annihilation called Prakritika. This is the annihilation called Prakritika, during which the energies belonging to the Supreme Person and his unmanifest material nature, disassembled by the force of time, are deprived of their potencies and merged together totally. So I'll have a whole lot to say about these verses. Fortunately, there's a small purport to text 23. We'll redo 22 responsibly. We have it up? Buddhindriyarta rupena Jnanam bhati tarashrayam Drishtyatva vyatirekabhyam Adyantavad avastuyat Buddhendriyarta rupena Jnanam Bhati Tadashrayam.
Jnanam Bhati Tadashrayam.
Drishtyatva Vyatirekabhyam.
Drishtyatva Vyatirekabhyam.
Adyatan Vadavastuyat.
Vadhendriyartarupena.
Jnanam Bhati Tadashrayam. Drishtatva Vyatirekabhyam. Adyatan Vadavastuyat. Other shit? Vaishnavis. Buddhi of intelligence, Indriya, the senses, Arha, and the objects of perception, Rupena, in the form, Jnanam, the absolute truth, Bhati, manifests, Tat, of these elements, Ashrayam, the basis. Drishyatva, because of being perceived. Avyatirekabhyam, and because of being non-different from its own cause. Adiantavat, which has a beginning and an end. Avastu, is insubstantial. Yet, whatever. Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. It is the absolute truth alone who manifests in the forms of intelligence, the senses, and the objects of sense perception, and who is their ultimate basis. Whatever has a beginning and an end is insubstantial because of being an object perceived by limited senses and because of being non-different from its own cause. Purport. The word drishtyatva indicates that all subtle and gross material manifestations are made visible by the potency of the Supreme Lord and again become invisible or unmanifest at the time of annihilation. They are therefore in essence not separate from the source of their expansion and withdrawal. Omagyanat Brandasha Gananjana Salakaya Chakshu and Mitanena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchuko Patubhischa Kripa Sindhu Bhavacha Patidano Pavane Bhyo Vaishnavi Bhyo Namaha. So, we are discussing the four types of annihilation here in the fourth chapter of the 12th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And this, what we have just read, is a lot of it is very technical. I can't say I have a complete grasp of this, but I don't understand a whole lot more than what we've read. But we can see how basically the different elements are merging into one another as the whole cosmic manifestation is winding down and merging into basically to the unmanifested state of prakana. So just to recap, there are four types of annihilation that are being described here. I'm sure you have them all memorized, but in case you don't, there was the, and in fact, verse 38 actually describes them very succinctly later on here. There's nitya, which is called the continuous annihilation, and that's the destruction of the body, that we all experience that annihilation of the body and rebirth continually. Then there's naimittika, which is called occasional. And that occasion is after each day of Brahma. So that was described in the first few verses of this chapter, the naimittika annihilation. Each day of Brahma is the partial annihilation, as we know. Now, what we have just had described is called prakritika, or elemental. And this is after the lifetime of Brahma. This is the complete cosmic annihilation after the entire lifetime of Brahma. It's mentioned that we're halfway through that. Lord Brahma is approximately 50 years old. He's got another 50 years to go. At that time, this is what happens. And there was a vivid description of the annihilation with fire and wind, etc., and how everything became a blazing, burning ball, and it's all gone. What we read today was a description of what happens with the different elements, how each of the elements merges into another along with the senses, the sense objects, everything else goes in, you know, they sort of combine one into another and collapse into themselves. Just like with creation, everything starts with pradhana and then prakriti mahatattva, and then everything expands outward. This is sort of the reverse process where everything is now expanding back in, and eventually pradhana is left, which is considered to be the undifferentiated, unmanifest material nature. Now, I've noticed in these verses and purports here, and both in this and also in Vishnusa, that sometimes prakriti is used and sometimes pradhana. They seem to be used a little bit interchangeably. I know there's a technical difference, I believe, and pradhana is a complete unmanifest nature. Prakriti is often described as like material energy, material nature. But at any rate, they are both considered eternal. And in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, of the five elements that Prabhupada says are there, that are being described, four eternal. The one that's not eternal is karma, right? Karma is temporary. But the others, the time element, prakriti, Ishvara, and jiva, are all eternal. So this prakriti or pradhana is an eternal, it is eternally there. It is always existing. It is Krishna's energy. And sometimes it manifests as this material world, and as we're seeing now, during the annihilation, it becomes unmanifest. So, all these elements have been described, how they're all consumed, they all return to prakriti, and now, verse 23, which we read today, is actually beginning of the description of ajantika. Ajantika is the third type of liberation, third type of annihilation described, which is actually liberation. So the next several verses that from tomorrow onward, is a continuation of today's describing the state of Brahman or Brahman realization. And it's really a state more of impersonal realization, how one becomes liberated from the false conception of this material world, the material body, the material energy, and understands one's spiritual nature. And in fact, in this purport, Vishnu Chakravarti writes a more lengthy purport to this verse, and the first thing he says is, the state of being one with Brahman in Anyantika Pralaya is by those desiring impersonal realization is now described. So it is somewhat of an impersonal realization, but yet at the same time, personalism is sort of interwoven within the verses and purports as well. So that's kind of what's going on and where we're at. And then at the very, towards the end of this chapter, or later in this chapter, the last annihilation, which is the annihilation of the material body, which is considered to be, what do they call that? Elemental? Continuous, because it's ongoing, life after life. So that will be described. So right now, we're just beginning to talk about the annihilation called adyantika, or liberation. So our understanding is that everything is coming from the absolute truth. That's described here in this verse in Purport, that all of these material elements, everything is coming from the Supreme Lord. And the material elements become manifest and unmanifest, but the soul does not undergo such change. So this Sanjantika liberation is differentiating the self from material conception, understanding one's spiritual nature, which is different from Prakriti or Pradana, or all of these material elements, that the soul remains apart, remains aloof from all of this. And so he's thinking, well, why is it called annihilation? Well, it's actually explained, I think, in a later purport or later verse, that it's the destruction of false ego. That's what the annihilation is. It's the annihilation of false ego or false conception. So therefore, this liberation or Brahman liberation is considered one of the four types of annihilation in this particular chapter. All right, so anyway, that's my best understanding of what's going on and what's being described here. So there are the Acharyas and the Vaishnavas in general, we understand that everything is coming from Krishna. We understand that there's a spiritual source behind all creation, and that spiritual source is a supreme person. Now, in the next few verses, some of the verses sound like an impersonal understanding, now, which is not false, because, as we know, there's three features of the supreme understand. Brahman realization, Paramatman, Bhagavan. We tend to, as Vaishnavas, emphasize Bhagavan, and to some degree Paramatma, and not so much Brahman. But yet, that still is an aspect of the absolute truth. It's the spiritual essence of Krishna, of the spiritual energy, the rays of coming from the body of Krishna, the effulgence of Krishna can be described in so many ways. You know, but this Brahman understanding that one is different from the body and that one is spiritual in essence and of spiritual energy is certainly a valid realization, although perhaps not the highest realization for the Vaishnavas. But throughout the next few verses, the commentaries help us to see the greater picture. And then there are certain verses interspersed, such as when we get to, I don't want to get too far ahead, but when we get to verse 28, says, the transformation of even a single atom has no ultimate definition without reference to the Supreme Soul. So because this is the Srimad Bhagavatam, the ultimate, the absolute truth, Krishna is always brought back in. So we may sometimes, get a lot of, technical understanding, or we may get understandings of Brahman or liberation, but always, always, Krishna is brought in. So in other words, it's kind of like, okay, this is going on in the material world, this is going on, this is annihilation. Now, but remember, Krishna's behind it. So we're being continually told, remember, the absolute truth is controlling all of these processes. Not a single atom has no meaning without reference to the Supreme Soul, the Bhagavatam says a few verses later. And in today's purport, it says, all material manifestations are made visible by the potency of the Supreme Lord and again become invisible or unmanifest at the time of annihilation. So I guess my takeaway from all of this and not understanding, a whole lot about all these interactions and intricacies of material elements, my takeaway is this, that this is all coming about by Krishna, by Krishna's energy, by Krishna's potency, and it's quite an elaborate process. Krishna is the Supreme Person, the Supreme Intelligence. He didn't just do things in a simple way. They're done in a very complex way in one sense. Of course, I guess you could say also in a very simple way of this continuous cycle of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. So understanding this concept of how Krishna is engineering everything with this in the material world is a very basic understanding for us. And it reminded me in the Srimad Bhagavatam of the Chatur Shlokas, where Krishna's very first instruction to Lord Brahma, he actually describes this. So, of course, we all know Lord Brahma sitting on the lotus flower, heard the word tapa. He, give me the Reader's Digest version, he meditates for thousands of years. He finally sees Krishna appears before him, And Krishna speaks the four essential verses, which then later became expanded as the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. But the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken to Lord Brahma in the four nutshell verses, or the four Chaturshloka verses. And interestingly enough, the first one I think is very relevant to our discussion today. Aham eva asya eva agre nanyad yat sarasad param paschad aham yade tachcha yovishishete soasmi aham. Brahma, it is I, the personality of Godhead, who was existing before the creation when there was nothing but myself. Nor was there the material nature, the cause of this creation. That which you see now is also I, the personality of Godhead, and after annihilation, what remains will also be I, the personality of Godhead. So, these are, of course, such essential verses. I remember at one time I had them all memorized. Now I've got to make sure I write them down to get them right. Don Mahan, you remember those? When we were in Miami, what was that, 1973, 74, somewhere back there, our temple president, Abhirama, made us all memorize the four Chaturshloka verses in the Bhagavatam in Sanskrit English. And I was really glad that, actually, I was really glad we did. You know, now they still come back to me, although they're a little fuzzy as far as memorizing them. But they're just so critical, and they just say so much. In fact, I was tempted to just the rest of the class just read the purports, but they're very, very long and extensive. They're wonderful purports, of course, and they're worth rereading occasionally, because Srila Prabhupada really explains the whole essence of Krishna conscious philosophy, and as, of course, Lord Krishna does. So the point here is that before the manifestation, during the manifestation, and after the material manifestation, after the annihilation, Krishna always exists. Now, our verse today doesn't exactly say Krishna always exists, says the absolute truth or Brahman exists, but we can understand the full understanding or purport of that is that Krishna is that source of Brahman, so it is Krishna who is always existing. Just a couple sentences from the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, we should note very carefully that the personality of Godhead is addressing Lord Brahma and specifying with great emphasizing himself, says aham, right? Aham eva asya eva agre, pointing out that it is he, the personality of Godhead who existed before the creation, it is he only who maintains the creation, and is he only who remains after the annihilation of the creation. Now, of course, the next verse, which is also a wonderful verse, this is 2934, just the English says, O Brahma, whatever appears to be of any value, if it is without relation to me, has no reality. Know it is my illusory energy, that reflection, which appears to be in darkness. So today we're discussing liberation from illusion, liberation from false ego. It's basically illusion. So this is what it is. Krishna says, what is actually illusion and what is not illusion? So illusion is not just double negative here, how to say that. Illusion is not just identifying with the material creation, and liberation is not just breaking that identification with material creation, knowing that I am, you know, not this body, I'm not part of this material world, but I'm the spirit soul. It's more than that. It's rather seeing that the creation, annihilation, and this whole material world, all of this material energy, this entire universe, is all part of Krishna. Illusion is seeing it as separate from Krishna, and real liberation is understanding Krishna behind it. Whatever appears of any value, if it's not in relation to me, has no reality. So that's the reality. The reality is understanding everything in relationship with Krishna. And understanding this material world, while we can say it's illusion because it's temporary. It's illusion because it's not the final reality. But it is real. It does exist. It's here. It manifests and unmanifest. Therefore, we can say in one sense it's not real, but in another sense it is real, obviously. Prabhupada explains this in so many places. One place that I thought was a nice description is an introduction to Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada says, the manifestation of this world is not accepted as false. It is accepted as real, but temporary. It is likened unto a cloud which moves across the sky, or the coming of the rainy season, which nourishes grain. As soon as the rainy season is over, and as soon as the cloud goes away, all the crops which are nourished by the rain dry up. Similarly, this material manifestation takes place at a certain interval, stays for a while, and then disappears. Such are the workings of Prakriti, but the cycle is working eternally. Therefore, Prakriti is eternal. It is not false. Okay? So, the manifestation of Prakriti is temporary and illusory. But the energy of Prakriti itself, Prabhupada is saying, is eternal, because it's an eternal process that Krishna is in control of. It's eternally an energy of Krishna. So obviously one of Krishna's material energy is one of Krishna's primary energies. Therefore, we don't deny it. We don't say that it's false. We don't say that it's not part of him or that it's illusion. We say it's real. It's part of Krishna. But it acts in such a way to put, to keep the conditioned souls in illusion. So we don't want to be an illusion. We should desire liberation from false ego, or this atyantika liberation. This is something that obviously the living entity benefits from, because we need to break the identification of matter. The ahankara, the false ego, is what experiences samsara. It's not the spirit soul. Because the soul or the Atma itself is unaffected. I was thinking we had a lot of discussion on this topic when we were studying the 11th canto, right? It seemed like we had several chapters that talked about the false ego and this experience of some in this material world. And we learned that the emotions, our mental states, birth, everything is due to false ego. Everything that we are experiencing here, although the self remains unaffected. And one who is, of course, self-realized or liberated understands the distinctions, understands that all of these transformations that are happening with the body and mind are not the real self. So the ahankara is, Prabhupada uses the word, is an imposition on the self, an imposition on the jiva. And because once we, as the jiva, accept the ahankara, we accept false ego, it forces us in this material world to accept the pain and the pleasure of material existence, as well as repeated birth and death. In one of the purports in 11th canto, Srila Prabhupada says, Prabhupada didn't write purports to 11th canto, so I'm not sure what my reference is here. Maybe it's a purport on a verse from 11th canto somewhere else. Similarly, the spirit soul has nothing to do with this material nature, but because of his mentality of lording it over, he's put into the position of conditional existence. So, you might remember back when we were in the 11th canto, that was my first time I'd really thoroughly gone through the 11th canto, especially the Uddhava Gita. As we went through it verse by verse like that, and it's pretty incredible. I was just so filled with knowledge and information, and interesting, called the Gita, it's almost like it's an expansion of the Bhagavad Gita, in more detail. And one of the chapters we read was chapter 23, the Song of the Avanti Brahman, and it was a very, very interesting chapter, because it was talking about the suffering of the jiva in the material world. And the question came, because the Avanti Brahman had undergone so much suffering, so much difficulty, the question was, where does the suffering come from? Why are you suffering in this material world? And so then there were many descriptions, explanations of what is the source of suffering. And some of those sources were, it comes from other people, or from demigods, from one's own body, the planets, karma, time. I think there were these different, these different explanations were given. And they were all refuted. And I'll say, no, this is not really where suffering comes from. So what was the source? False ego, ahankara. That was what the conclusion of the Vanti Brahma was. No, it's none of these things. It's nothing external. It's the false ego within, the ahankara, which is the source of suffering. And that suffering is experienced in the mind of the living entity. I mean, the ahankara, the false ego, creates the false identification with the body and the mind. Therefore, the spirit soul, the jiva, the atma, while is not exactly suffering, because the soul is pure and really cannot suffer, but because of such strong identification with matter, with the false ego, there is the experience of suffering. So that goes on due to this, and that is the great illusion, this material world that we're being talked and that we're being told needs to be annihilated. Is one of the types of annihilation, is this liberation from that false ego. So the ahankara gives shape to material existence. Vishnacharya Thakura says that the quality of ahankara, it defines our bondage in samsara. The false ego, ego means identity, so false ego means a false identity, and the ahankara firmly establishes that false identity with matter. Therefore, accepts the gross and subtle material bodies and its concomitant suffering. So all the suffering that's experienced by the body and mind is due to the false ego's acceptance. So we've been talking about the creation here. And, of course, as we end annihilation, and if we go backwards, talking about annihilation, but if we go back to creation, it's the other way around, where the first element is pradana, the unmanifest material nature, that transforms to the mahatattva, the total material energy, the 24 elements, then the whole thing unfolds. But the point where the soul comes into matter and contacts matter, touches matter, that's ahankara. That is the position of the false ego. The first contact with matter of the soul. And that is where the false identification with matter begins. It's kind of like downhill from there on. Once that happens, once we accept material elements, once we accept the body and the mind as the self, it's like here we are for many, many lifetimes. That's the beginning of the identification, the beginning of the suffering within this material world, the beginning of the cycle of birth and death. So the ahankara, the identification matter, develops material desires. Why? Because desire is natural to the soul, right? Desire is there. It's an eternal principle. So if we're not identifying with our spiritual body and our spiritual self and our spiritual relationship with Krishna, having spiritual desires in that way, then if we reject that, we accept the material body and senses, then naturally material desires will arise. Material desires arise. Then what happens? An appropriate body is created to fulfill those desires. And here we are. We find ourselves in a series of different bodies transmigrating through this material world. So we've come into this material world due to our desires and to inhabit a body, and then the material world that's described is manifested due to our desires. So in one sense, well, we say Krishna is, of course, behind everything, and of course he is, but he would not even need to create this material world were it not for the material desires of living entities. So to fulfill the desires of the living entity, this whole material creation, maintenance, and destruction comes into place. So the ahankara causes identification with the body, but it also creates the idea that I'm no longer a servant of Krishna. I mean, they're like inverse ideas, right? The converse of identifying with the body is that I no longer identify with being a servant of Krishna. So we're in a double bind. Not only are we an illusion, you know, as far as what our identity is, but we've forgotten our real identity. And all the suffering in this material world comes about from that forgetfulness of Krishna. So we falsely identify with the body, we falsely identify with its pains and pleasures. We continue to act on the desires of the body, the senses, the mind, intelligence, and thus experience an ever-increasing implication of karmic reaction and rebirth in this material world. So, not a good situation. So we need to see things in relationship with Krishna. The process of getting out is no harder than the process we got in. We simply have to reverse that identification with identifying with the body, identifying as the material world, and start to identify as the soul. And not just a soul floating in space, but a soul in relationship, the soul, in relationship with Krishna, as eternal servants of Krishna in a loving relationship with him. So to not see things in relation with Krishna is illusion. And that's what we need to do. We need to reestablish or regain an understanding how everything is actually in relationship with Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita 5.12 purport, in the Bhagavatam, the cause of anxiety over the result of an activity is explained as being one's functioning in the conception of duality, that is, without knowledge of the absolute truth. Krishna is the supreme absolute truth, the personality of Godhead. In Krishna consciousness, there is no duality, or illusion, we could say. All that exists is a product of Krishna's energy, and Krishna is all good. Therefore, activities in Krishna consciousness are on the absolute plane. They are transcendental and have no material effect. So once we begin acting in Krishna consciousness, once we begin acting according to our constitutional position, once we start acting in the spiritual platform, on the spiritual platform, no longer in the material conception of life, then the process of real liberation begins. So, of course, there's one type of liberation being described here as Brahman realization or impersonal realization. But for the devotee, real liberation means service to Krishna. It means realizing our position as servants of Krishna, loving Krishna, serving Krishna. So, Brahman realization is not so much valued, not of so much interest to devotees, because it's there automatically. It's automatic. If you understand your relationship with Krishna, you understand your pure spirit soul, you don't identify with the body and this material world. In other words, the devotee who was realized is obviously not only realizing he's Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan realized. All are there. Because it's complete realization, it's successive, and if one has the topmost realization of understanding Krishna, the person, then all of the subsidiary realizations are going to be automatically achieved. So, this is, of course, very all interesting information about the different types of annihilation, and to me, as I said, my main takeaway from this is how it's all going on under Krishna's direction, and how this whole process is meant to help us to realize that we are not this material body, that we are pure spirit souls, and understand our relationship with the absolute truth. And here we are getting information as far as the activities of Krishna. What does he do? How does he manifest? How is everything going on? And this is all actually very important. It's very important information because if we understand the nature of illusion, if we understand how this material world works, it helps us to be able to get out of this material world, how to undo it. Okay. So, that's about all I have as far as my limited realization on these verses. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. That's comes Madan Mahan Prabhu.
I was once talking with a Baptist minister about the creation, and he said that the creation was created out of nothing. So I was thinking maybe to show him these verses from today, that this is how we break nothing down. So after you empty everything out of it, you have this pradhan, which is pretty close to nothing in one sense, but in the other sense, it has the potential to become everything else.
You know, I'm pausing because I was trying to remember where I read it. I think it was in one of Vishwanath's purports when he was describing Brahman, describing this with the Pradhana, he used the word void. He said, kind of like void like. I mean, it's not total, there's no total void, obviously, but, you know, it is almost void like. And because really it's unmanifest, nothing's happening, right? It's inert.
Mentioned the unmanifest, but still, because it wasn't that submissive of a relationship that trying to understand, it was more or less trying to see the differences. It didn't go so
because well. Because logically, something coming from nothing doesn't really make sense, does it?
No, they say that's proof of God.
Give it to Stevie D. What was it?
Well, it's a Christian argument that they say that's proof of, or evidence of God's omnipotence. He just creates out of nothing.
Because he creates something from nothing. Why couldn't he have created, why couldn't something be coming from him, though, and then he uses that in creation, yeah?
Well, yeah, I know, then you're getting into semantics, but I mean, you know, it's punditry, but, I lost my thought, but, nothing, so nothing is compared to what? I mean, obviously it's not, you know, it's a transcendental source, and, you know, material isn't the substrate of reality and so forth. Yeah, it says it's nothing like, perhaps. Fucking words.
Yeah. So it's that'd be the kind of thing philosophically, if you really broke down as someone who really understood Christian philosophy and vice, whether it's really that different or whether it is differences in terminology, or, you know. But yeah. Anyway, we don't usually ascribe nothingness to Krishna, though. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just thinking. Like these few chapters or this section of the Bhagavatam, that if we don't be careful, we can get this kind of understanding of impersonalist philosophy. I guess this is part where they kind of, you know, manifest some of their thoughts from, because the way it's described, if you don't, you know, like focus strongly, you can easily get a different idea from personalism to impersonalism.
Yeah, and I think it is always a danger. One thing I was noticing in some of the purports in our edition, but even more so in Vishwanath's purports, Vishwanath Chakravarti's purports, he's constantly bringing back to personalism. He's saying, yes, it's saying this, but we understand this. So we understand, you know, the deeper personal relationship. So yeah, I mean, and that's why we need guidance of the guru and acharyas. Because if we only had verses of Vedic literatures, I mean, I know I'd probably be in trouble and give all kinds of misconceptions, you know, without having Prabhupada's purports and having, you know, understanding. And as we know, everything is there in the Vedas, right? Everything is there. So Brahman realization is there because that's a reality. You know, just like we see in Bhagavad Gita, you see Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Sankhya Yoga. It's not that these are necessarily the highest or absolute, but Krishna doesn't leave anything out, right? It's all there. But then one has to have the intelligence and the good guidance, you know, to be able, as you're saying, not to get distracted or fall into, oh, yes, it's all, you know, everything is Brahman or something. Friend Govindapur.
I was contemplating on that when you say nothing, but the matter does not reveal itself what the matter is. It has to be a consciousness or conscious being reveals the matter. Yeah. So nothingness cannot reveal nothingness.
Right.
So a conscious being has to reveal.
In other words, you're saying you wouldn't even be able to know or see or understand nothingness unless there was consciousness to be able
correct.
To see it.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay, yeah.
So then comes to a point where the indifferentiated homogeneousness that you can address as the objecto or void. Pradhan,
yeah.
The English word, what I learned, that when we say unmanifested, means it's not visible to me. That's all.
Right.
It's not that it is not there.
Right.
It is there, but it's not visible.
Right.
So Pradhan has these elements, 24 elements, all, and the material nature. The both they have an eternity, that's true. But Madhulila 20.273, Prabhupada writes that it is the Krishna or Vishnu does not intervene directly with the material nature. it is the Shiva who takes the form of time, causes the sixth transformation.
Mm-hmm.
So the nature, as in the Parvati you read, the nature is eternal, but nature also has two manifestations. One is matter, one is person. She is also a person, she is also dead matter.
Mm.
So the dead matter transform into six changes, which is time is causing, Shiva is causing. But the nature remains nirvikar. Nirvikar means like Krishna desire, everything takes place, but he never transforms anything.
Right.
He remains nirvikar. I don't know exactly the meaning of that. Nirvikar means it never transforms.
Right, there's the two theories, the theory of transformation and the theory of...
Well, like Vibhaktabad, they say that what it is, but you have to change your vision to see what it is not.
Hmm.
So you have to change the vision. This is the impersonalist conception. But the transformation is literally, it transforms.
Yeah.
Like milk turns into yogurt. It is a transformation. So here it says in the today's sloka that there is no transformation of the nature. So it's not that nature is transforming, but the elements that nature carries transforming by the Shiva time.
Yeah, I think
so.
Yeah.
Both are correct.
Okay.
And the last point was like that you have given very nice that the material nature is reality, also is illusion. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says it's reality because it has a connection with Krishna. That's the only reason. If anything is not connected with Krishna, it's not
connected. No reality.
That's all
it
boils down
to. Thank you very much. Yeah, I was just thinking the first part. You said that, you know, Prabhupada very deliberately and uses those words manifest and unmanifest all the time, right? He always talks about it being manifest and unmanifest. And that's exactly as you said, meaning that something is potentially there, but has not yet come out, right? So yeah, it's not that there's nothing. It's not pradana. It's not that it is void or nothing. In other words, it's that the potentiality is there for all the material elements to come out. When it's actually when Mahavishnu glances at it, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the glance of Mahavishnu activates the pradana to start up the process of creation. Yeah. Well,
that's why the intervene is that the glance.
That's the consciousness.
Has a halo.
Yeah.
And Prabhupada writes in 22, oh, you got it, probably in the purport you'll see, that that halo is actually Shiva who unites with the material nature and causing it visible, everything.
Okay, very good. Any other technical information anyone can help us out with? Okay, we got one.
Real quick, I was thinking about the nothing Christian concept. I think in part they were reacting to the Greeks on that argument, where there was a sense of the material world eternal, and God, like the demiurge, is almost a functionary of the cosmos that's eternal. So there's a whole history. You know, so when you're dealing with these people, and usually you get some guy only half understands it himself, so, you know, it's the terms and history of the debates, you get funky. I think the term is the Latin term is ex nihilo. Ex nihilo.
Well, at any rate, I think if we present our Vaishnava understanding,
yeah,
that's probably best, not to try to delve into understanding exactly all these other philosophies. Okay, was there anything on the lady's side?
Just on your last point, how it's nice to understand this because it helps us with our process in Krishna consciousness. And I was thinking that paraphrasing the Sri Upanishad 11, only to those who understand the process of nations and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of the
Yeah, it's kind of like you have to understand how you're tied up to be able to become untied, right? Or else, of course, only one who is untied can untie this also. Okay.
What is nothing?
Actually,
they have a constant zero, literally, they put on, and What is nothing?
It's a good question. Is there any, well, we're really getting out there. No. But, you know, I would say in a Krishna conscious philosophy, nothing, there is no nothing. Nothing does not exist. That's a little contradiction. Anyway, that's a logical contradiction, but we'll just let it go. Nothing does not exist.
If nothing doesn't exist, then why you say nothing? It doesn't exist. So where does word, why?
How is there a concept? Okay. Because we understand something, therefore the negation of that would be nothing. You know, it's kind of like, I'm getting a little far off field here. Yeah. It's not like Krishna, like Prabhupada said, you know, if you've seen gold and you've seen a mountain, you put in your mind together a gold mountain. There's no gold mountain, but in your mind, you put it together. So since you've experienced something, you've experienced, so the negation of that would be not there.
But it has an origin where it's formed from. So nothing, even if you said that doesn't exist in a logic way, then that the whole illusion is also has an origin. Something has to be there in order to have a reflection of it.
Something has to be there, right.
So nothing doesn't make any sense. I mean, I don't know if they understand what the meaning of nothing.
Well, I agree. I don't think there is such a thing as nothingness and within our philosophy because, I mean, unmanifest is probably as close as we come to, you know, to nothingness. Okay. Oh. We'll,
I just
let's leave this one for more research by the pundits.
I just want to add this one that in Guyanese English, nothing is translated as not.
Not?
And not means the Lord.
Not means what?
Not means Lord, like Jagannath, not Lord of the universe.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you all. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.